Hi, everyone. It's Richard Beatty, co-host and producer of Mind Matters with Rita Schulte, and she's with me right now. As life changes, so does programming. And in the next 3 weeks, we will vacate this Sunday noon broadcast. One thing I have learned in media for more than 53 years is that the cream rises to the top. Here's the long and short of it. A series of public affairs programs on counseling will be distributed over Crawford stations in Denver, specifically highlighting the need for churches to embrace counseling and psychology during this long mental health crisis. According to Barna research, in both rural and urban America, when someone is in need of mental health assistance, the first place they go, whether they are believers or churchgoers, agnostic or evangelical, is the local church. In this series, we have highlighted some parachurch ministries as well as church mental health ministries. In addition, Useful to God Ministries and Sound Century Audio will be doing long form. As I said, this will be the long and short of it. One day a week on the program hosted by Dr. James Spencer that I produce and sometimes co-host on Life Audio called Thinking Christian. And so, here we go. Rita Schulte's on the line with me to discuss this new show we're calling Counseling Culture. Rita Schulte, let's start with you.
Thank you, Richard. Good to be here and good to be talking about what we're going to talk about today with this whole idea of mental health and how that's translating into the kind of the intersection between, you know, faith counseling and secular counseling, and what's the right or wrong approach as this culture faces enormous pressure from the secular world not to speak Christian.
Yeah, we both just read an article, and I know you have some questions on that. In recent years, there's been a hesitance of merging faith-based counseling with science or psychology. Yet, more and more, there is some peace and respect in that culture war. You have said it yourself in some of our shows that the best thing is a real hybrid between faith and psychology and having those two disciplines partner in mental health. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, I think we all would agree that there is a perceived value conflict between, you know, counseling and religion and spirituality. And so I know a lot of the secular organizations that I speak and write for are very careful about my interjecting strong faith language. I have mentioned God. I can say higher power, but yeah, you better not say Jesus. But then every well-known person in the field can talk about Buddhism or New Age things. And so there's a disparity there. So especially now, I think this is so important because we're at such a crossroads with, you know, things like gender, sexual identity. It will come to a point where I won't be able to offer any religious alternatives if a client comes to me, maybe brought by concerned parents, right, for a sex change. I would be compelled to refer them for that. And that's very troubling.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because we had Otis Ledbetter on, and he was talking about he's in California, and it's a very interesting thing. He's a pastor, and he's written a lot of books on family and heritage builders, those kind of things. But he has said that he learned counseling from the very best, from Dr. James Dobson and others in the field. And, you know, California being a really hotbed for Christian counseling, that was a big thing. But he said there are times where he does refer people that come to the church for maybe some of these same issues that you're talking about here.
Yeah, it's really sticky. And I mean, I think some counselors are uncomfortable addressing issues of faith. I mean, I think we'd all agree with that. Even though the majority of Americans say they highly value faith, The same can't necessarily be true about mental health professionals, right? And according to that article that you and I both read, researcher Pamela Paul, if counseling students aren't being trained to access and treat from a faith-based perspective, how can they meet the basic needs of people who are looking for this in this culture? I mean, my work is mostly with Christians, but I have had a fair amount of non-Christians over the years, and I have just taken the perspective that I want to develop in a person this idea of curiosity. I'm not going to preach to them. I mean, I'm not allowed to, you know, evangelize, obviously, but I want to develop a curiosity with the client, especially because when people come to counseling and they're facing very difficult life circumstances, a person who may have been kind of closed off to faith might be a lot more open to that at this particular time in their life. And so I want to take advantage of that simply by exploring some things and seeing what their willingness is. I mean, if they want to go there, then we'll go there. If they don't, we don't have to. But I think the lack of comfort and competency in this area, you know, as that article said, is reflected across presentation, publications, and even listservs. And at best, this is because of a lack of knowledge, training, understanding. And at worst, I think it's just, you know, the culture trying to blow off Christian clients of faith, in particular, those clients who are conservative or evangelical.
Yeah, which is very interesting when you think about what we're facing sometimes. Do you think that some of it has to do with the Christian nationalism or those things that are happening in the political world that has kind of blunted our effectiveness?
Absolutely. And I mean, all I ever think about is when we did that show with Dr. Aaron Lutzer, and he wrote that book. He's written, you know, We Will Not Be Silenced and When a Nation Forgets God, you know, Seven Lessons from Nazi Germany. And if you really look back, I mean, every Christian should be reading that book because it's exactly what's happening. You know, the government in Nazi Germany had this whole idea and the propaganda that came out, and what is first and foremost in my mind that we're seeing today is this whole idea of, you know, brainwashing the kids, getting parents out of the way, taking away parental rights. And I have, you know, clients, my own daughter literally moved from the county she lives in Maryland, to a different county because of this very reason. And so those freedoms are slowly being etched away. Whether we're talking, you know, a political platform or whatever, and it caused the ruin in Germany. And I think that's the game plan here. I mean, if you do those things, you know, if you get parental rights away and now the government can do whatever they want with your kids, they can set whatever agendas, and they have. All of these things that were once mandatory or that are now mandatory weren't mandatory when my kids were little. I could opt them out of whatever I wanted to. You know, you're not opting out of much today.
Right. One of the things that, you know, I think sometimes we have nobody to blame but ourselves, because now we've got this perception that we're hate mongers and we're all of these things. And we should be love mongers. That's exactly what our call is, to love God and to love people. And that.
Well,
is,
you know what,
not
Richard?
What
I mean, this
see.
Is something Lutzer pointed out too. I mean, they frame the language very particularly to make you look just like that you are a hate monger. And so, you know, these terms that get out there, you know, everybody sees Christians in this light. And I have always said it's not legalism, it's called a standard of righteousness. And we're called to that. And we may not be able to totally turn the culture tied around at this point. I mean, Lutzer says it's too late for that, but we can stand firm where God's placed us, and we can have a sphere of influence where we are. And we
right.
can't minimize just
what,
the power
how
of prayer.
Do we, how do we turn that perception around? Now, it's probably not going to come from the media, where we have to almost be our own media to show who we are. And maybe counseling is the answer here. Maybe if people are going to the church and they're seeking that love and purpose from a higher power, just that the church is going to be compassionate and they have that image of the church, that would be great.
Well, I would love to say that's 100%. I know since I started counseling, I can say that many people that came to me when I worked at Grace Ministries as a lay counselor and beyond felt like the church was the place they went to be accepted. Perhaps they'd had an abortion or they were involved in some other sin, and they felt like they were really shot down and judged. And that's terrible. The church should be a place of acceptance and love. And, you know, for me, I just think whoever you're working for, I mean, research is pretty robust on the fact that the therapeutic relationship is everything with the client. We're wounded in relationship and we're healed in relationship. And I think the therapeutic relationship becomes a place where, you know, if you befriend your client, if you can have that client trust you and develop a relationship, you can pretty much say anything to that person because you're a safe haven. You've earned that right. And for many people that come, you know, they're struggling with trusting others. You know, they've been hurt, they've been betrayed, and a lot of times it's been by the church. And that's sad. But I think, you know, if we put the secular hat on, you know, there's just really no place to try to convince clients that they're wrong about their biblical convictions. And so I think that's what the secular world wants to do. You know, they want to convince people that all that religious stuff has really been what's guilted and shamed them. And maybe it has. So it takes a good counselor to tease all that out. But I think, you know, simply put, the faith of the client and the faith of the counselor must always be respected. And again, you know, for me, for my non-Christian clients, I'm going to, you know, ask questions that evoke curiosity, because curiosity isn't threatening, it's inviting. And many people who are suffering are looking for God. And I want to build that bridge if it's something my clients want to walk over.
Yeah, of course, we hear a lot about the separation of church and state. And James Spencer has a really good look at that. He said what it is that there is separation between church and state. There is separation between the sacred and the secular. And I thought that made more sense to me than anything else that I've ever heard about that subject. One of the organizations that we're going to be really partnering with is Colorado Community Church. Just like with our physical health, we all have mental health that needs to be nourished and cared for. Some of us have mental illnesses, but those are illnesses, just like a heart condition or diabetes. That's what makes this a public affairs show. This is not paid for by anybody. This is just Crawford reaching out in this very important issue. To get help locally, coloradocommunitychurch.org/mental health. I'm Richard Beatty reporting, Crawford Media Denver. Hi, everyone. It's Richard Beatty, co-host and producer of Mind Matters with Rita Schulte, and she's with me right now. As life changes, so does programming. And in the next 3 weeks, we will vacate this Sunday noon broadcast. One thing I have learned in media for more than 53 years is that the cream rises to the top. Here's the long and short of it. A series of public affairs programs on counseling will be distributed over Crawford stations in Denver, specifically highlighting the need for churches to embrace counseling and psychology during this long mental health crisis. According to Barna research, in both rural and urban America, when someone is in need of mental health assistance, the first place they go, whether they are believers or churchgoers, agnostic or evangelical, is the local church. In this series, we have highlighted some parachurch ministries as well as church mental health ministries. In addition, Useful to God Ministries and Sound Century Audio will be doing long form. As I said, this will be the long and short of it. One day a week on the program hosted by Dr. James Spencer that I produce and sometimes co-host on Life Audio. Do you think that some of it has to do with the Christian nationalism or those things that are happening in the political world that has kind of blunted our effectiveness?
Absolutely. And I mean, all I ever think about is when we did that show with Dr. Aaron Lutzer and he wrote that book. Well, he's written, you know, We Will Not Be Silenced and When a Nation Forgets God, you know, Seven Lessons from Nazi Germany. And if you really look back, I mean, every Christian should be reading that book because it's exactly what's happening. You know, the government in Nazi Germany had this whole idea and the propaganda that came out. And what is first and foremost in my mind that we're seeing today is this whole idea of, you know, brainwashing the kids, getting parents out of the way, taking away parental rights. And I have, you know, clients, my own daughter literally moved from the county she lives in Maryland.
I do want to talk a little bit about sanctity of human life. We're at that time of the year where that anniversary of the passing of Roe versus Wade. And of course, that's been overturned by the Supreme Court. For many years, psychology and even Planned Parenthood has talked about people who have gone through an abortion experience or even a miscarriage that are not affected psychologically. And yet there is available to people post-abortion stress therapy, mainly from those what were called crisis pregnancy centers. They're called life centers now often. Planned Parenthood had put that together so people wouldn't feel guilty about having an abortion. And I'm wondering if some of the animosity that we hear now about this and some of the confusion on both sides of this issue, when the mother's life is in jeopardy, and we've heard some of those cases. There are not a lot of them, but we do hear those cases. But this strict law now, we're doing a victory lap sometimes, and I'm wondering if there's still something else that we have to deal with, and is it more psychological than anything else?
Yeah, I think that I have counseled plenty of women over the year. I mean, I volunteered at the crisis pregnancy back when Mike was, my husband was president for 13 years there. And I didn't see too many people that didn't come away with feeling a lot of guilt and shame. Now, there are people that seemingly don't. I always say when you bury things, you bury them alive. And the jury's not out on when that or if that may come back up for a person who has had an abortion. Of course, we don't want people to live in torment. We want them to know and understand the forgiveness of God. Of course, they're forgiven. But when people walk in avoidance, I think that or denial, I think part of what revs up the pro-aborts is if I've done that, I don't want anybody stirring that pot for me. I'm going to say I'm fine with it. I'm going to say, you know, it was my body, my choice. And if I say it enough, maybe I come to believe it. But there's always going to be that part, right? Because I don't get that activated by something unless it's hitting a nerve. So when I see people responding in those types of ways with anger or hatred or all of that, something else is going on deep down inside. And so, you know, anger really is an emotion that sits on top of more vulnerable emotions like hurt and sadness and rejection and fear, all kinds of things. And so I'm always curious with people, you know, let's explore that a little bit. You know, is there something there? Most of the folks that I have counseled through the years that have gone through an abortion have had to do a lot of work to work through that. And they do. And they come out on the other side of it because God is a forgiving and a loving God. And I believe there's freedom for that. But I also believe there's a reason why people on the other side of this issue are reacting so strongly to it. And the facts kind of speak for themselves. This is a human life. There's no question about that anymore. You know, I mean, years ago when we first got in this, there was all this dispute about that. When does life start? All of that. There's no question anymore. So you've got to come face to face with that. And it's one thing to say, well, I'm a person who, you know, well, I got mad and I, you know, hit my kid or something. There's another thing to come face to face with. I'm the kind of person that will hit my kid. See, because that's speaking about my identity, my intrinsic worth. And that's a real hard place to go. I mean, that's going to bring up all kinds of shame. So, you know, it's just such a multifaceted and very complex issue. But I think that there's always going to be a lot more going on in the surface than we think. I always say what lies beneath, right? That's where I want to go. I want to be like an emotional archaeologist, digging deep, dusting things off, and having the client take a look at that, right? To see if there is anything going on.
Yeah, no, that's good. Rita, we talk a lot about purpose. I probably talk more about it than you do, and calling. In regard to suicide prevention, how can we as a culture bring that vision for each individual and speak to their futility? You know, I call it bringing utility to futility.
So I guess I'm not quite sure what you're asking, like in terms of somebody who's lost a loved one to suicide or just...
No. I'm talking about people as far as in regard to suicide prevention.
Okay. Yeah, it's funny because I had this conversation with a suicide loss survivor client the other day. And I think prevention lands us in one space when we talk about suicide. There's a hope that this won't occur. And so it gives us a measure of control in our society, in our personal dealing, perhaps with a loved one. We believe, I mean, you even see this with just, you know, regular grief for someone who's died. Let's say your husband was having symptoms and you're trying to convince him to get in the car and go to the ER because you think he's having a heart attack, right? And he doesn't want to go. And so by the time you end up convincing him and getting him into the car to go to the hospital, he gets there and it's too late. And so now you're guilt-ridden and you're blaming yourself. Well, if I should have just, you know, gotten him, I should have convinced him, I should have tried harder, I should have, right? Which we do. We kind of drown in the guilt. And that prevention model is such a great model, but it's hard when you talk about suicide loss survivors because suicide loss survivors don't get a do-over, right? We're not in a prevention mode anymore. It's a postvention mode. And so if we're going to look at suicide, you know, just as in the culture and what we can do about it or how we find meaning and purpose after a loss like that, you know, we're over in the preventative side and there's hundreds of ways people can volunteer and help and, you know, do all those things. But I think what is important to understand is that once an event like this has occurred, people are no longer in the prevention mindset. You've got to be in a postvention mindset because that's the only thing that's going to help you make your way through the guilt because there isn't anything you can do about it anymore, right? A plus B isn't going to equal C because it's already done. And so it's helping the person then coming to a place of acceptance with what has happened and trying to rebuild a life with purpose and meaning that can still be good. And as I say that, it sounds, oh, okay, well, there's the formula, work it. This is very slow work. This is years of doing this, right? To lose a loved one to suicide. But prevention is profoundly important when we look at the statistics now in our culture about suicide. I just read an article of another celebrity, not a real well-known person, that last week that took their life. I think it was some rock star's wife. So the good news is, I think a lot of that exposure has given us more of a platform to talk about it, which is so important, because for so long it's still very stigmatized. You know, I've been in touch with some folks in Africa, believe it or not, and other countries, Poland, that have reached out to me, read my book, have lost a loved one to suicide. And I mean, Richard, you wouldn't believe the stigma, even in the church in places like Africa. The church has totally turned their back on this one particular family. And the shame and the, you know, and we see that culturally across the board oftentimes. I mean, Asian cultures, you know, you don't talk about it. It brings shame to a family, all of that. So I think, you know, if we're talking about prevention and purpose, we really need to get the word out there, the psychoeducation piece, to show people we got to talk about this stuff, because it isn't going away. And secrecy only breeds more shame and silence, and that's never an answer. We have to have these conversations.
Do you think that we're more aware of these things now, or are we less aware?
I think we're more aware. I think we definitely are, because you see a lot of churches getting on board with this now. I know with the loss of Rick and Kay Warren with their son. He died in April of the same year Mike died, and you know, they've were kind of the first to really get on this train. And I think a lot of churches have followed suit. I just don't, there just needs to be more programs, especially for schools and things like that. I mean, I can remember counseling a kid a few years ago and went to a Christian school, and one of the kids, you know, took their life, and it was never talked about. The faculty, the students, there is a protocol, right? When something happens like that in the school system, that really should be followed. And certainly, you know, mental health evaluation and, you know, checking up on these students who are close to the person who died, getting them help, getting them evals. So yeah, we need a lot more of those programs. And hopefully, as I speak around the country, I see, you know, lots of people coming to my seminars that are, you know, in the throes of this. So that's encouraging.
I hope this has been encouraging for you as well. If you need help, or if you know someone who does, go to community.org/mental health. That's community.org/mental-health. I'm Richard Beatty, Crawford Media, Denver.